From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. State officials say that more than 100,000 service members from Georgia were deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan between 2001 and 2012. Nationally, about 20% of veterans coming back from these conflicts have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injuries. Alchemy Sky Foundation is an Atlanta organization that helps people heal through music. They recently worked with veterans to create this. That song is called The Just Fire, and a group of Metro Atlanta veterans created it. Jay Budd is a musician and founder of Alchemy Sky. He helped with the music project and joins me in the studio. Jay, hello.
Good morning, Virginia. Thanks for having us.
Well, thanks for being here. Also here, Marcus McCreary, an Army veteran. He worked closely with other veterans in helping them write A Just Fire. Hello, Marcus.
Hey, good morning, Virginia. Thank
good
you for
morning.
Having me.
Thanks for being here, both of you.
Yes.
I'm curious, though, Jay, why did you and Alchemy Sky decide to focus on veterans for this project?
I think as we got involved with the veteran community, we realized that there was an opportunity to create some non-traditional programs so that military veterans could process their unique experiences in a way that might be a little more authentic and real to them every day. And I think music can do that.
Yeah. Had you worked with veterans before?
We have. We partner with the VA. We also have a program at the Veterans Empowerment and Organization, which is a homeless shelter for veterans just on the west side of Atlanta. But this was different for us in terms of walking post-9/11 veterans through the process of writing and recording a song.
Yeah, so you did it with people like Marcus. Marcus, how did you find your way to this?
Me and Jay actually were both working with veterans programs, and we were actually suggested through Wounded Warrior Project to meet up with each other. And then once we met, it was just like, let's do this.
All right. So this is, you call this project music therapy. Are you actually doing therapy with mental health professionals or making music as therapeutic practice?
We were making music in this program and having a therapeutic outcome. What we have been told is, if we turn down the idea of therapy and turn up the music, we can still get the same effect. And I think it makes veterans a little more comfortable versus emphasizing the therapy.
Had they worked with making music before this project, any of the veterans?
Their experiences were varied. Some of them did, but some of them did not.
So you, had they all been diagnosed with PTSD or other traumatic brain injuries or other disorders?
Most of them were medically discharged from the service, so they had a variety of different challenges that they were working through, and I think the music was able to help them.
So Marcus, the project started, 10 veterans offered about 15 weekly sessions. What did you do in the sessions? Teach them how to write, produce music?
Yes, we went through the whole writing process, creating music, finding instruments and stuff. We mostly were working on the writing part so that they can speak on, the experiences they had in their careers and lives.
Yeah, in fact, there's a reel showing the process of this. It's just terrific. Mm-hmm. Here's one of the creators of A Just Fire. His name is Jamal Joyner, served in the Air Force, and he's talking about it.
Well, especially with this particular song, it let me express myself, my experiences in the military, especially being deployed.
I just fired, never getting tired, gotta keep it moving. Downrange, too long, time to bring it on home. Gotta call my wife, when I get off, I'm feeling all alone. So tired, sleepy, but still wide awake. Bombs dropped, soul frozen, feeling myself shake.
It actually drew things out that I really didn't know I was feeling all the way, because the song I wrote is really a story about how I felt when I was in Iraq.
So Jamal was one of those. There's also, we hear from Keisha or Kesha Sharp, Antoine Williams, Milton King. So did you have everybody contribute their own little bit? How did they collaborate? Yeah.
Well, everyone had their own style. We had some country singers in there. We had gospel singers in there. So when we finally chose a song and was trying to pull it together, we were such a unit that we just decided to do it in a hip-hop style. But of course, everybody's like, man, next time we do this, we got to do a country song. And next time we do it, we got to do some other type of songs. But I mean, it just became together because, veterans, we naturally mesh together, whether it's my idea or your idea. It doesn't matter. It's one idea. And if I can help you on that, whether it's a country song or a hip hop song, I'm going to jump on it. Like our guy Milton, completely country guy. But I'm talking about he let it all out, and he's one of the best, my favorite parts of the song, honestly.
He said something beautiful, too. Yeah. He said something like, we're all tuned to the same frequency.
Exactly.
So what was it about being in a group of veterans together? Did it just feel like a safe place for them, you think?
Yeah, it's more of having people that understand what you've been through, and when you talk about it, it's not getting a blank face back. It's getting a yeah, I know what you're talking about face back, you know? So once you get around each other and then you start talking about these experiences, you know, some people, especially out in the civilian world, you'll hear like, you need to toughen back up. You know, it's something we hear in the military, but there's certain times that that doesn't need to come out. You know, so when we're talking to each other, we know when to tell each other, nah, you need to toughen up. And then we know when, like, yeah, bro, I feel you.
How did you decide then on the name Adjust Fire?
Well, it was kind of the concept of the whole program when I was speaking with Jay about it. And when we was hearing the music and then that song kind of, who did it hit first? Was it? It was one of us that it hit first. And then Adjust Fire was just like, yeah, we can't focus on what's going on now and what life has going on. We need to adjust our fire. You know, that's a military term. So, and once I said that, everybody's eyes just lit up like, yes, that's what this is all about, adjusting fire and keeping it moving.
That's a musician and Army veteran, Marcus McCreary. Also with us, Jay Budd, musician and founder of Alchemy Sky Foundation in Atlanta. They both worked with veterans on a project using music as a therapeutic process. Well, Jay, you mentioned Wounded Warrior, and we know about the Veterans Writing Project, the Theater of War Project, performing ancient Greek tragedies about warriors. Let's Dance. So what do these creative arts do that more traditional therapies don't?
I think they present an authentic way for a veteran to process their experiences. So this, I think, is a great supplemental to their journey in terms of their mental health treatments. But to me, the music, when we work with veterans using music, I feel like we're validating their voice, and they're taking what they have learned or what they're working on in their other traditional therapeutic methods and being able to interpret that in their own voice. So one of the deeply moving experiences for me is when a veteran writes something and you can feel, you can sense the catharsis on their face, and then when everybody starts to nod, there is this kind of feeling of unity, like you're not alone. And I think that's what art can do, finding ourselves in tricky places and then helping each other come out is something that I think art can serve for all of us.
Yeah, we had some tear jerkers.
I can imagine. And you said you're going to do a country song next. Are you actually going to continue this project with other songs?
We are. We're in the fundraising mode right now, so we're going to have Veterans Music Project 2.0 in the fall, and we're going to have two different genres. So we are raising money right now at alchemysky.org, and we're excited to get the next one off the ground.
Nice.
So, Marcus, you served in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Kuwait. Can you tell us a little bit about your transition back to civilian life? What was happening for you?
It's actually something that I noticed that a lot of us have in common. The difference between the military and civilian life is very hard to explain, but you literally have to live it, and then people are like, yes, that's how I feel too. So it's trying to adjust to not everyone having the same core values. That's a big one. There's seven Army values. Every branch of service has their own values, but everyone has values. And then when you come to the civilian world, it's a little bit different because everybody's trying to win at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. So you have to watch yourself. And then also we have this big selflessness that the military puts into us so that we can help each other, you know, build when, you know, one another are down. So when we come out, you know, we kind of get in these trusting situations and people may take advantage of it, and we're still going to give it our all because we're dedicated. You know, that's part of our values. And, you know, selflessness, you know, I don't really need it, but I see that you really want it, so let me go ahead and let you have it. And we'll find ourselves giving and giving and giving. And a lot of the veterans that I was talking to, I noticed that, like, they were just running out. Like, they would love to do more. They would love to be more. Like, and they have people that's pressuring them to pay this or help them with that. Because, you know, once we get a check, we're a target.
Yeah.
You know, you're getting your veterans dependency check or whatever. That once it comes in, you know, your family around you, your friends around you, people know you just got a check coming. So it's like we want a piece of it. And it's like, oh, man. But when I first got out, I was living with a bunch of veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like one collective pot. The bills were getting paid. The food was in the house. The gas was. But once you get out, it's like, now I'm watching someone else have it, and then I don't, you know. And I noticed that was a lot. I've been through therapy. I've been in the hospital. I've, you know, so I've had to talk to a lot of veterans. And I almost become a counselor. Even when I'm sitting in there, like, we sit and we talk, and notice that it's the same thing. Like, we have so much love to give. Like, it's just better to get around people who receive it and give it, you know. And that's the difference between veterans with veterans versus going to, like, a doctor,
right,
or something like,
right,
that. So this is that love being, you understand how I love, you know, I'll give it all.
Mm-hmm.
Just show me a little, you know, I'll give it all. And then having that reciprocated. And that's what the group was really like. I had some people in there rapping that had no business rapping. I mean, it was just one harmonious group. Like, we were just all being together. Let's do something together. It was great.
It comes across in the music. It's just a wonderful composition, wonderful production as well. But as you're talking about, you know, people get out of their bubble, and it's a lot more difficult.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of people don't know how to relate to them, you know, if you know that somebody's been in the military.
Yeah.
And we know that according to the VA, 21 military servicemen and women commit suicide each day in this country.
Yeah.
It is just staggering. Yeah. So in general, Jay, you know, you've worked with veterans before. What do you think is working and what is not when it comes to treatment and just helping people integrate back into everyday life?
I think it's important to Marcus's point that you start with a core group of veterans. So what we did at the Veterans Music Project is we started with a core, but then the music has an opportunity to connect that group of veterans with the larger community.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this type of exercise, and hopefully we'll be able to organize some performances, and hearing the veterans perform and sing, I think is an opportunity for people who haven't served to really kind of understand what they go through. And what was really powerful about our project is that because the veterans kind of had a mission or an objective, I think it was easier for them to tell their story because they were in a group. And you can take that song, and it's now on Pandora and YouTube and Spotify and Apple Music. And we can create a larger connection to the greater Atlanta community because of that song.
Yeah, and I'm sure people beyond that as well. You did earlier this month throw in a Just Fire release party. What were some of the reactions from the vets and their families?
It was fantastic. We have a board member, Alan Jones, who owns Hi-Fi Buys, and we had it there. And probably the most powerful moments there were when we played the song, and whether they brought their spouse or their significant other or their mom to have their voices come through these big speakers, and then have whoever they brought look at them in a way that maybe they hadn't looked at them before was just a fantastic moment.
Yeah. Okay, so we have just a minute left. I'm wondering, could this be a model for other groups working with vets? What do you think, Marcus?
I really think it could be. One thing that's about music is it's way more natural. You know, when you're letting out these words, when you're thinking about what you're thinking about, you're doing your own therapy. It's self-therapy at the end of the day. Like I said, we had a bunch of tearjerker moments. I've seen people come into having, you know, they're coming to their own revelations as they're writing their music. I think it's a great program. I know it's served its purpose with me. A lot of the other veterans, they can't wait to get back to it. So, yeah, I think this is a good start on something. What do you call it? Non-traditional type of medicine.
And we're also going to build by bringing back, you know, the old guard, inviting new veterans so we can continue to keep this momentum going.
Yeah.
Jay Budd, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Marcus McCreary, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Marcus is a musician and Army veteran. Jay Budd, also a musician and founder of the Alchemy Sky Foundation in Atlanta. And again, you can hear the song just about everywhere. Conversation doesn't have to stop here. We'd like to hear from you. How can we help our combat veterans adjust to civilian life? If you served in the military, how did you cope with PTSD? Let us know. Conversation is on our Facebook group, GPB Radio's On Second Thought. Stay with us for a conversation with Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Just over a month after President Trump announced during his State of the Union address that he hopes to end HIV in the next decade, his Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar traveled to a CDC conference in Atlanta to provide more details on the plan. Azar sat down with GPB's Robert Jemison to talk about how he hopes to implement the initiative across the country at the federal level and how the administration plans to put significant resources in place in the hardest hit areas of the country, most of which are in the South, including four metro Atlanta counties.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Glad to be with you.
So in your speech today, you talked about treating every new HIV diagnosis from this point forward as a public health failure. Yeah. With the new money allocated, the data, the tools, how are you guys going to go forward? What tools are you going to use to curtail that number of the 40,000 new diagnoses each year?
So there are really four things that we've got to do. The first, we've got to get people diagnosed. You know, 80% of new HIV cases in the United States come from individuals who either have not been diagnosed or who know they have HIV but are not in treatment. So we've got to reach out to them. But here's the really wonderful thing with the data. It's a very focused problem. 50% of new HIV cases are coming from 48 counties, DC and San Juan, Puerto Rico. Four of them are right here in Georgia, Cobb, DeKalb, Gwinnett, and Fulton counties, and they'll get a very focused effort on them. So that's what we're doing, is we're adding to the $3.4 billion we already spend on HIV and AIDS prevention and treatment in the United States mm-hmm. with an additional program that's very geographically and demographically focused.
So let's talk about the counties and the target areas across the country. $291 million in the first year in the proposed 2020 budget. What can we see in the areas like the four counties in Metro Atlanta in the first year with that $291 million? What partnerships are you forging? What are you directing the directors of departments under you to do in that first year?
Well, actually, the largest tranche of money in that $291 million will go right here to the CDC in Atlanta. Over $140 million will go to the CDC with very targeted efforts to keep refining our data so that we know we've got to know the people we have to reach. And if we can get to them, we can get them on treatment, we can get them prevented from further spread. We also are going to send Surge, a HIV healthcare workforce, out to assist states and counties. Because what do we have to do? We have to diagnose people who are currently stigmatized or not being reached. Those include men who have sex with men, individuals in the gay, bisexual community. It involves African Americans. It involves Latinos, Alaska Natives, and American Indians. And we've got to really focus that effort to reach them and get them diagnosed. Once we get them diagnosed, we got to get them treated. Mm-hmm. Because if you take the antiretroviral treatments and get your viral load to undetectable levels, undetectable equals untransmissible. You literally can't transmit HIV to somebody else. And then we reach the people who don't have HIV, who are at high risk of getting HIV. And if we can get them on this drug, it's called PrEP, you can have a 97% reduction of the chance of getting HIV. And then finally, we respond. We will have outbreaks. 10% of new HIV cases come as a result of the opioid or drug crisis in the country from injectable drug disease, use of injectable drugs. And we'll have outbreaks. And we've got to respond. We'll have a surge force to be able to propel in to deal with those response activities.
Now, two things you just mentioned there that I want to follow up with. You talked about the treatments. The medicine has come a long way over the past several decades. What about the cost of the medications? How are we going to keep people on the medications once they get on and not risk lowering that effectiveness after they lapse a treatment because of insurance lapse or they fall into a coverage gap or they're in a state that hasn't expanded Medicaid? How are we going to make sure that those patients who need those medications can afford it and have access?
So many of the individuals who have HIV get access to treatment as well as medication through the Ryan White HIV AIDS program and the ADAPT program. So the antiretroviral drugs are provided through that program, and the states and the centers actually work with us to procure those medicines and get them provided, of course, to lower income individuals. We're funding also $50 million to the Health Resources and Service Administration's community health centers, where, again, so many individuals in those particular disadvantaged communities seek their health care, and through that they can get what is federal government discounted pricing for the PrEP drug that prevents the transmission of HIV to individuals. So we're working on a comprehensive approach to get people on treatment, stay on treatment, and get them on the PrEP if they're at risk of getting the disease.
And you also mentioned the stigma associated with HIV. So how does your department work with the communities, work with your partners to curtail the stigma? That's not a health topic. There's not science behind removing a stigma. So how do you guys hope to attack that stigma, especially, you know, in Atlanta and the South and other parts of the Bible Belt where religious conservatives really struggle with issues of unprotected sex, condoms, premarital sex, which all have links to HIV?
Well, I think it's just very important that we treat this as a public health issue. It's about a disease, and it's about individuals getting to the disease. And we've got to educate individuals that there's no stigma in being treated for a disease or preventing the spread of a disease. And so you're right. So much of the issue of spread of the disease is happening in seven more rural states, and often in the South, and particularly rural communities in the South. We face issues where individuals who should be on this PrEP product, the prevention product, won't get it because they don't want to go into the pharmacy and call out and have a pharmacist actually say, "Hey, Joe Smith, I've got your PrEP," and have people then associate you with various behaviors. Mm-hmm. Or to your antiretroviral therapy. And so this is where these interventions are going to be so important in a very localized way, because we're going to actually be discovering with state and local public health partners how best to reduce that stigma and help people. It might involve mail order. Maybe it's getting people's PrEP delivered to them in a brown bag at home so they don't have any issue of stigma on getting the medicines. But we'll learn with these very localized, focused efforts tailored to each community.
So the stigma goes both ways. Some public health departments in states and counties are doing things to actively advertise PrEP or, you know, promote access, but they're afraid to put a state seal on it or a county logo on it because they're afraid of backlash from their legislature or the local community. How do you guys work with the governments in these local areas to curtail that stigma as well?
Well, we'll certainly lead by example. Having the President of the United States in the State of the Union declare this as a public health issue and having his personal commitment around it, talk about a way to deal with and confront stigma there. Secondly, you're going to see the HHS logo, the CDC logo, the HRSA logo, the FDA logo, the NIH logo, all the great and incredible brands of this department all over everything, and I hope states and state public health departments will follow our lead.
Secretary Azar, thank you so much for your time today, and we look forward to keeping up with the progress over the next year.
Thank you. My pleasure.
It's a pleasure.
Among the films now in production in Georgia is the third installment of the Bad Boys franchise. Bad Boys for Life stars Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. Whit Norris has worked for years as a sound mixer in Yollywood, and he's on this project. Kalina Buller, host of GPB's The Credits podcast, talked with Whit about his long career in sound design, which began at a college radio station and continued in a documentary production company. That's where he says his career took an unexpected turn.
One of our clients with that company was Ringling Brothers, so we did a lot of work with the circus and shooting all their films and spots, and also the Walt Disney Ice shows, which they promoted. And the company was a little mismanaged, and they ended up closing the production side, and it just became an editorial house. And a group of us left to go work for Ringling Brothers, basically to go to New York. They had 150 boxes of film. Mm-hmm. That basically they didn't know what was on there. It was pretty much the history of the circus.
Wow.
And we cleaned it, restored it, repaired it, and transferred it. I became unofficially a circus archivist, I guess, or historian, maybe would be the word. But that was when I first really got my hands on film and learned how to cut and splice and things that, crafts that aren't really around anymore now that we're in such a digital age.
Mm-hmm. How then do you... How did you make the transition then? If that's where you got your start, how did you become then a sound mixer? And as you say, the digital age, how did you make that transition?
Well, the thing about it is after New York, a group of us relocated in Atlanta. Uh-huh. And we formed a small company where we did commercials and things. And I was still doing location sound work at that time.
I see.
Freelance and with the company that a group of us had formed. Eventually, as business relationships always change, everybody kind of went their own way, and I just started strictly doing sound. Anything from industrials. I worked with Craig Miller here in Atlanta for years and years. Craig's been around for decades here in Atlanta doing everything from Coca-Cola to, I guess, IBM. And then I had an opportunity to start working on some low-budget movies. There was a director, producer, David Pryor. He was kind of the Roger Corman of the Southeast. He shot a lot of movies along the Gulf Coast and in Mobile. And I don't think he really knew my name for the first movie. He would just say, "Hey, sound, come over here.
Right.
I'm going to have these two guys walk, and they're going to talk, and you might need to put wireless mics on them." I said, okay. And eventually, he really inspired me because he said I was like the best sound guy he'd ever had. He had made 30, you know, low-budget movies, real B movies. And he really inspired me because he said I did a really great job. I go, well, I wonder who you've been hiring.
Right.
And anyway, it kind of took off from there and started working. One of my first, I guess, major films that I did, I was the sound utility on. I worked with Bobby Anderson and Pud Kuzak, was My Cousin Vinny.
Very awesome.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
How was that? How was working on that film?
It was hard not to laugh out loud.
I can imagine.
For the whole crew. It really was. It was amazing. Joe Pesci was just incredible. Marissa was, too. She was very young and not a lot of experience at that time, but she did an incredible...
She would never know it.
She did an incredible performance that obviously won her an Oscar. And Fred Gwynne was great, too.
Yes. Oh, man. To be a fly on that wall,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
or but just to be a PA on that set, even.
Yeah, it was hard not to laugh out loud.
Let me ask you then. I have been working now in the locations department here in Georgia for about 14 years. I obviously have a general working relationship with the sound department.
Yes.
But I don't know anything about the sound department. I'd like to ask you, what is the general hierarchy for sound? Because you are the production sound mixer. Is that the head of the department?
That is the
head. In production?
Yes, that is the head of the department. Then after that is the boom operator.
Okay.
And then there is the sound utility, sometimes referred to as the third.
Okay.
The sound utility is really a challenging job. Some people like to think of it as an entry-level job, but you have to know, already have a lot of skills. You have to be able to be the second boom operator when two booms are needed. You're generally responsible for wiring and miking all the actors and keeping up with that. And also, you're the administrator. You handle all the paperwork, the time cards, supplies. You order those when they're needed, make sure the equipment, when things need to be repaired, that they get sent out and are repaired, or repair them yourself.
Right.
So that's a big responsibility. The boom operator, backing up to that position, they operate the set. They are the set manager.
I see.
They control everything on the set. Generally, they have more of a relationship with the first AD, assistant director, and even sometimes with the director. If there's a problem, they'll be the first one to speak up because I'm not right in the middle of the set. They are. Sometimes people get nervous when they see me come on the set. What's wrong? Why are you here?
Oh, I see.
Because I'm usually around the corner in some kind of, usually a quiet place where I'm recording and mixing.
Right. Okay.
But I mean, I come out, I'm there for rehearsals and blockings to see what we are and discussing with other department heads if there are any needs that we have or that we need help with, which a lot of times is locations.
Yes, it is.
We depend a lot on the locations department. The locations support us by being able to help lock up a location, by, you know, making sure the neighbors next door, they don't have their greens people there, landscaping people there with the leaf blowers and the weed eaters. What else? Help me. You're in that department.
No, I'm right there with you because I've been in those very same situations.
Yeah. And like if we're shooting in a restaurant, which the Silver Skillet, I know, is a neighbor here.
Yes. We film there a lot.
To the studio. What I love about the Silver Skillet, and it's been filmed there for commercials, movies, and everything, is the breaker box in the back actually has stickers on some of the breakers. Turn off when filming for sound.
I love it.
They've been there for years.
Yes, 4 years. It's like they just know instinctively.
Yeah, and I think what most of those switches are for the exhaust fans for the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah,
you are essentially somebody who lives and dies by the sound. Do we sound okay right now microphones?
Yeah, we sound great. I think we sound great.
I was thinking on my way over here, I said, okay, we have to make sure everything's on point because Whit's going to be listening.
No. That was one of the things that impressed me with your podcast is how great they sounded. I thought they sounded very NPR is the term I like to use, which people don't realize, but NPR is really has been the cutting edge for broadcast sound on the radio for years. They were the first people to actually use DAT machines in the field years ago.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you have any aspirations for an Academy Award in sound mixing?
You know, Sure, I would love to have an Academy.
I say let's go, right?
Yeah, you know, but so the thing about it is with me, you know, I do all these movies with numbers after them. Let's see, Anchorman 2, Fast 5, Fast and Furious 7, Fast 8, Hangover 3, yeah. Bad Boys 3. I don't really think I'm going to get an Academy Award with a movie that has a number after it.
Well, guys, if you're listening out there, let's put him on a number one, okay? Let's go first out for Whit. But yeah, okay.
Kalina Buller speaking with Whit Norris, a sound mixer working in Georgia's film industry. His latest project is Bad Boys for Life, which is being shot in Atlanta. Their conversation was recorded for GPB's The Credits podcast. And you can subscribe to that and all of our podcasts for free at gpb.org/podcasts. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. In Macon, classical musicians are stepping off stage and into the ICU. GPB's Grant Blankenship reports on music as medicine.
The intensive care unit at Nevesant Health Hospital in Macon is like ICUs everywhere. Nurses and doctors constantly checking in on the seriously ill, all while trying to keep the noise down. But there's one sound you can't escape.
So much beeping.
That's Nevesant ICU nurse Taylor Rickert.
These monitors beep, the machines beep, the pumps beep, everything beeps. You get home at night, it still beeps.
Rickert says the beeps are important, of course, because they communicate about the conditions of patients. She couldn't do her job without them. But in terms of emotional well-being, the beeping can be tough. That's why it was a relief when violist Keone Boulding unpacked his instrument near one of the ICU nurses' stations on a recent morning and launched into a set of mostly Christmas favorites. Boulding was invited here by Avinash Barr, one of the ICU's doctors. Barr doesn't play music himself.
I play the radio.
But about a year ago, he recognized the value of having music in what can be an emotionally chilly place.
It's cold. It's very clinical. I felt the need that at least we needed to introduce the concept of at least something more human or humane in the ICU to kind of make it a softer environment.
And it's not just that music on the ward feels nice. Barr says there's science behind this.
There's some studies that have shown that when you use music, you've reduced the anxiety that patients have, the fear that patients have.
One study showed that music before and after surgery was better at reducing anxiety than anti-anxiety medication. Studies suggest classical music works best here. For the elderly, playing the music they enjoyed in their youth has documented benefits.
You reduce some delirium or episodes of confusion because it's something they can relate to.
Studies suggest not all music is created equal for the purposes of intensive care. Jazz? It might require too much mental attention to be therapeutic. And heavy metal and techno can apparently cause heart arrhythmias in a clinical setting, so no turning it up to 11. Dr. Barr says musicians in the hallway are a nice start, but he's not sure patients hear it from the other end of the ward.
So I think some other ICUs do have the facilities for that, where music's piped in directly to a patient's bedside.
That would allow more personal music choices, too. Keone Boulding plays a set at either end of the ward so everyone can hear. Deneen Schumann is among those outside their loved ones' rooms listening in. Schumann shoots video on her phone as Boulding plays and sings along until he's done. And then she checks to see how her father-in-law enjoyed it.
Oh, just to see the look on his face. The music just makes your soul just dance.
It turns out music can be good medicine, too.
That's GPB's Grant Blankenship. Today is the first day of spring, and we're kicking off the season with some picks for shows, festivals, and events taking place around the state with Kalundra Smith. She's theater critic and Arts ATL contributor. Hello, Kalundra.
Hi. Nice to see you again.
Nice to
it's
see
great
you again.
To be here.
And a new season.
Yes.
Everybody's outside putting on their shorts. Well, this is by no means an exhaustive list, but some of the things that are on your radar. So let's start with visual art at the Jepson Art Center. That's one of the Telfair Museums in Savannah. A Rembrandt show. What is it?
Yes. So I have to say the Telfair is one of my favorite museums, period. I started going there when I was in college. And they have this Rembrandt exhibition that is all based on etchings from his time living in Amsterdam amongst the Jewish community. And so they're all etchings of just kind of daily life, which is totally different from what we expect from Rembrandt. We're expecting things from Rembrandt that are like very abstract. And this is something that is very much inspired by like slice of life. And so they've got a couple dozen of his drawings plus some from his teacher that are going to be in that exhibition. So this is like kind of a once in a lifetime to be able to see sort of thing.
Okay,
so I'm excited.
That's the Rembrandt show. It's called Rembrandt and the Jewish Experience, the Berger print collection, starting March 15th. Then European Masterworks, the Phillips collection. This is going to be at Atlanta's High Museum in April. So what's there? What are some of the highlights there?
So I'm a sucker for Impressionist art. I love my Van Gogh, my Monet, my Manet, all that. So if you are also in that vein, this is your exhibition. And so it's going to be an opportunity to see some of those contemporary pieces that a lot of people may be used to seeing, like, on TV or on their computer screen or like learning about in school but have never seen in person. That'll be the time to be able to see them in person.
Interesting choice though for the High. It's been creating much more diverse programming, capturing a much more diverse audience. So what is this Phillips collection? How does that fit into that?
Well, I would say that, you know, a lot of the art we see in Atlanta in general, particularly at the High, is very contemporary, and this is an opportunity to get some of those classics in there. Plus the other exhibitions they have on display still are a nod to that diversity. And I think we have to also broaden the way we think about diversity too. So having something that is an ode to the past mixed in with a whole bunch of stuff that's very much now is certainly diverse.
All right. So you're looking forward to some gallery shows too. What are you looking forward to?
Yeah. So one of the things that's been on my radar is the Sharon Louise Barnes exhibition at the September Gray Gallery just opened the other weekend. Her style is very similar to like Carol Walker and also a little bit of Larry Walker too, you know, that father-daughter duo. And she works with like building materials and paper to create these they look like sculptures, but they're on canvas, you know? And then she also has these things that are like suspended from the walls. I mean, she really, when I think of her work, I think of motion and flight. And as an artist, part of what she is aiming for is transcendence and looking at the human experience and how we overcome things. So when you see her work, you'll definitely see some of that in the way she uses color and movement.
Okay, so that's Sharon Louise Barnes. It's called The Magic Within Us at the September Gray Gallery in Buckhead. And we'll have a list of all of the things that Kalundra is talking with us about. Arriving at the Alliance Theater tonight, premiere of a new play by Pearl Clegg, Angry, Raucous, and Shamelessly Gorgeous. What's it about?
Yes, so, you know, Atlanta loves Pearl Clegg.
Who doesn't love Pearl Clegg? In fact, I just want to tell everybody that she's going to be our guest tomorrow for On Second Thought, so people can listen at 9. We have a full hour with her, just kind of expanding on her whole life. I'm so looking forward to it and terrified at the same time.
I'll have my radio dial turned way up for that because I just, like, adore her. So this is her new play. This is brand new world premiere for the Alliance Theater, which she's their playwright in residence. And this is going to be a show about generational differences amongst women. This is going to be a show about sustaining a career in art over time. It's got comedy, it's got drama, and basically it's about these two women who are friends who find themselves back in the States after 30 years of living as expatriates in Europe. And they're invited back by these two younger women artists to be a part of this festival. And each group of women has different impressions about what the experience is going to be like. And they're kind of having to work through that to be able to make this festival happen.
So interesting for a woman to be an aging artist writing a play about aging artists confronting what younger people coming up and, you know, eating their lunch possibly. And it's beautifully named, Angry Raucous and Shamelessly Gorgeous. Again, you can listen to a conversation with Pearl Clegg tomorrow here at 9 a.m. and also at 2 on GPB. And of course, on your podcast, whenever you want to do it. All right, so in the theater realm, also Footloose premiering at Theater Buford next month. This is the 1984 classic starring Kevin Bacon, Laurie Singer, John Lithgow. Here's a clip from the original musical. Okay, how are you going to top that at Buford Theater?
So let me just say, Theater Buford is a new theater company. They are in their inaugural season at the Buford Community Center. And I mean, if you haven't been out there, the facility is absolutely beautiful. And they have really brought a wonderful brand of professional theater to Gwinnett County that was much needed for that community. And so with this production of Footloose, I'm very excited to see what they can do because they just closed a great production of A Streetcar Named Desire. So with this production of Footloose, though, I got some inside intel saying that they're going to be doing it with African-American main characters, uh-huh. And then they're going to kind of fill out the ensemble with more diverse folks. So they're going to be switching up some of the dance styles to kind of reflect what African-American music would have been during the 80s and during that time. So I was like, huh, that'll be interesting to see how that changes, you know, even with the same music, changes how we see the show.
So is it a musical? I mean, is it straight play based on
it's musical.
Full-on musical.
It is full-on singing and dancing, and there's going to be some interracial love in there. So it's going to be an interesting way to see Footloose done.
All right, so that's at Theater Buford, new mm-hmm. theater. Calendar's recommending that we check that one out. All right, so then this is, of course, festival season being spring, and Festival de Microteatro opens tonight. Mm-hmm. This is featuring two weekends of original plays by local Latinx playwrights. Venues across the metro Atlanta area. That's pretty ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
For yeah. their first time out?
Yes. So Aurora Theater and Latinas Who Lead in Media have partnered together to give you two weekends of 15-minute plays by local Latinx playwrights starring local actors. So this is going to be a really cool experience, and it's all themed around the American dream. So all of the different plays for these two weekends are going to be based around some aspect of the American dream coming out of this community. And I will tell you, Latinas Who Lead did a showcase of plays, original one-act plays, last fall, sold out two weekends in a row at Rob Morello Studios. So I would say get your tickets now.
Huh, no kidding.
Yeah.
And they're at different places, you said.
Yes, they're going to be at different venues all around the city.
Okay, so Festival de Microteatro, keep your eye out for that. Again, we'll have a list online at gpbnews.org. All right, just want to mention a nod to the Macon Cherry Blossom Festival mm-hmm. starting this weekend, running through next week, and you can actually see it in full bloom because there is a Macon Cherry Festival cam, live cam, so you can see them blooming right before your eyes.
That's cool.
Actually, I'm not going to promise that. The Apple Blossom Festival is coming up in May in East Ellijay, mm-hmm. the Woodbine Crawfish Festival in Woodbine, the Blessing of the Fleet in Darien, so plenty, plenty, plenty of things going on, and Shaky Knees coming on May 3rd through the 5th. In Atlanta with Beck, Incubus, and Tears for Fears.
Yeah.
So you can, you know, do your asymmetrical haircut and go see Tears for Fears. But you're also looking forward to the Atlanta Film Festival. This gets underway April 4th. How long mm-hmm. does it go on for? Is it like a week or 10 days
no,
or something?
It's the 4th through the 14th. Okay. So there are plenty of opportunities to engage with the Atlanta Film Festival. And I will say, like, you know, we hear a lot about the film festival in this city because the film industry is having such a big impact on us. But I would say this year's festival lineup, I think, is truly a time where we're seeing a reflection of that because we're seeing major films like opening night film, I think, is from the same filmmaker as Crazy Rich Asians.
Wow.
You know what I mean? So we're seeing big sort of blockbuster things come. Plus, there's some like documentaries I'm excited about. Like there's a Miles Davis documentary that's going to be playing during the festival. There's also one about a young woman she's a young Muslim woman who wears a hijab, and she is trying to play D1 basketball.
Wow.
So, I mean, there's just going to be so much. There's going to be such a swath of stuff. Plus, there's kids programming. They're like, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids series is all like short films for children. And I love a good short animated film. So I'm excited.
So that's the Atlanta Theater Festival. Is that also going to be, is that just at the Plaza or is it around town?
No, so it's got a couple different venues. So the Atlanta Film Festival is mainly at the Plaza Theater, but then there's also going to be some stuff in the Black Box at Seven Stages. I know that they're also at a few different theaters around town. So when you look on your schedule, make sure you look at what theater you're going to be at.
Also, Dad's Garage has something coming up, Big Stupid Parking Lot Carnival. What on earth is that?
Yeah, so for folks who are fans of Dad's Garage, very unique brand of comedy, they are familiar with Bacon Fest. Bacon Fest has been a very popular event for the past few years, but what Dad's Garage has decided to do is kind of remix Bacon Fest and do like this huge carnival with like crazy games that are based on the improv games they play on stage and then some very unique ones. So there will be elements of Bacon Fest in there, but then there will also be like some crazy kooky stuff. So I'm looking forward to seeing what they do that's going to make it top Bacon Fest.
Okay. Get ahead of Bacon Fest. The Laughing Skull Comedy Festival coming up. Now, this is a really big deal festival, I understand.
Oh, yeah. So Laughing Skull has become like the place where like up-and-coming comics get their break. I mean, there are people from Laughing Skull who end up going on to do Adult Swim series, who go up to do The Daily Show in New York. I mean, this is like the place where you get discovered, really. And so the Laughing Skull Festival will be in the beginning of May. And there's going to be, again, different venues. I know they're going to have quite a bit at City Winery, which is a great place to like take in, you know, have a cocktail and like take in some comedy. And this is going to be up and coming comics from all over the world. Plus, you get to see a lot of established faces because a lot of comics who have big names like Amy Schumer, Chelsea Handler, whoever, they'll come down and they'll just see up and coming talent. So you never know who you'll see at Laughing Skull.
All right. This is getting deep. How do you do it all, by the way? How do you manage this? Sometimes you got to sit home and read. And we have a couple of New York Times bestselling authors, Martha Hall Kelly and Jessica Handler, who her new book, Magnetic Girl, is coming out. Where can we see them?
Okay, so they're both going to be at one of my favorite bookstores, Foxtail Bookshop in Woodstock. If you have not made your way to downtown Woodstock to not only check out the cute restaurants and, you know, the tea rooms and all that stuff, Foxtail is like one of my favorite locally owned bookstores. It's a group of women who run it. They bring in a lot of women authors, and they're going to have both of these ladies here this spring. So it's not to miss because the Foxtail experience is so much more intimate. Like, it's not like the experience of like standing in line for hours and hours to see your favorite author. Like, it's really a chance to get to like come up to them and talk to them and really share with them about the books that you love that they've written. So I think that's what makes Foxtail so unique.
All right, that's going to be on April 20th. Martha Hall Kelly and Jessica Handler, hoping to get to speak to Jessica Handler about her book because, you know, she's written memoirs, but this is her first novel, so I'm excited about that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we are now in spring. Families may want to get outdoors for spring break. What's going on at the Atlanta Botanical Garden or other outdoor venues?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, Orchid Days is happening right now, and I think it'll be wrapping up this spring, but you definitely still have a few weeks to be able to experience Orchid Days. So that's always a lot of fun. Then they've just announced that Imaginary Worlds is coming back, and it's going to have an Alice in Wonderland theme.
Oh, wow.
So there's going to be a giant rabbit sculpture with, like, the clock and everything made out of flowers, and I'm, like, so ready to see this. So that's going to be a great place to be. Plus, you know, for those folks in Gainesville, the Gainesville Garden has its own programming that you have the gardening, they have the cooking in the garden up there, and you have the amphitheater where you can see concerts up there. So I love both campuses of ABG.
Plenty, plenty, plenty to do. Theater critic and Arts ATL contributor Colender Smith, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
And how can we not close with another song from Footloose?
Okay.
We're going to listen to Holding Out for a Hero. While I tell you that you can submit your ideas and things that you're looking forward to this spring, the conversation is on our Facebook group, GPB Radio's On Second Thought. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk. You can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org or leave a message at 404-500-9457. Take your chance. Be a hero. If you missed any of today's show or want to listen in your own time, hit the podcast link. We're at onsecondthought@gpbnews.org, and you can subscribe to all of our podcasts. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for joining us for this beautiful first day of spring.